The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
I'm Brett.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
This week on The Cyber Show, another pitcher goes to bat. Peter and the Risks form. Julie goes over the threshold. Simpson starts hacking early. Brian plants a seed the side. Doug is a wild duck, and the frauds just keep coming. Here we go.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
Fred here. On April 4th, we have our monthly advisory call for Angel to Exit. Join us to discuss anything you want about your early stage company. Later that day, we'll have the CEO's Forum, where portfolio company CEOs get together and discuss issues and help each other identify synergistic improvements. On April 11th, go to Angel. You can pitch your company, get in front of investors, get on the radio show, and tell the world about your new company. Also on April 11th, the All.net Members Forum. You can meet with cybersecurity experts from around the world and discuss all sorts of interesting things. For more details, go to thecybershow.co.
For details on anything you hear about at The Cyber Show, go to thecybershow.co.
Breaking news on The Cyber Show. The U.S. has threatened China with banning of TikTok. This because the social media giant is spying on U.S. persons and using influence operations to affect the body politic. China cries foul. In other news, a U.S. surveillance drone in the Black Sea is destroyed by Russian fighters. That's because the drone was being used to target Russian military operations in Ukraine. The U.S. calls foul.
And now a word from our sponsor. Tuesday, April 11th, go to Angel. Pitch your company to investors, get a global listing, and get on the Cyber Show. Sign up at a2e.co.
To get in touch with companies presenting on the show, you can go to thecybershow.co and look them up. During this segment of the show, we talk to historical figures from the cyber world. We're discussing the history of the cyber world with Peter Neumann. His long career exemplifies a great deal of the time and effort and expertise involved in the development of the cyber world that we live in today. The Risks Forum, I don't know, boy, how long has it been running?
Started August 1st, 1984. I think it was 84, maybe it was 85, but I can't remember.
If it was 84, that's, you know, that was just before computer viruses were first, or just after computer viruses were first the published
thing. I'd already been editing the ACM software engineering notes, started in 1976. We created that in 1976.
But that's not the same thing, right?
No, that's where the Risks Forum came from. Every issue of the Software Engineering Notes had a section on risks to the public in the use of computer systems, okay?
Have you made a copy of that and made it available on the Risks Forum?
All that's online.
Oh, I love it. Okay.
Okay. And so then when the Risks Forum was created, I used to post this summary of all of the problems that I had recorded periodically. And it grew so big that I had to write a book, and that was 95.
Yeah, but long before the book, getting contributions from all over the world.
Right.
And so how many people have contributed to the Risks Forum over the years?
Probably thousands. I don't know.
Oh, more than thousands. I mean, it's got to be tens of thousands, right?
I don't know. I have no idea. It's speculative. But the point was, we had, even in the pre-ACM forum days, when the first shuttle failed. Remember, they had four computers and one backup computer, and they couldn't synchronize.
That's right.
I got Charlie, what was his name? First name I've forgotten, Garman, to write an article on what had actually happened. And it turns out there was a 1 in 64 probability that the bootload would fail, because there was a serial number that was randomly generated, six bits.
If it was zero, it wouldn't stop.
It had to match the backup with four primary computers. But they never told the guys who designed it never told the operational crew.
Of course not.
That if it failed, they should just reboot it, and then it would work.
It was 63 out of 64 times.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. And so they took them 3 days to discover that flaw.
Yeah, that's a little bit too long when you're trying to land things.
And Garman came up with a six-page article in the Software Engineering Notes. on exactly what had happened there and the whole story. So I published a whole bunch of early things back in the 70s, late 70s, on things that had gone wrong, and cataloged them classified them and published summaries periodically, once a year at least. And so that led into the ACM Risk Forum. Adele Goldberg came to me one day and said, "Hey, we want a public facing into something on the internet that could be available to everybody in the world and would be an ACM thing." So that became the Risk Forum.
All right. So you put that, what year did that start?
That was, I think it was 85 or 84. I don't remember.
Yeah. And how was that sent out?
It was sent out by email.
There you go. And that was, you know, long before people understood anything about the web.
Let me just check here. I've got...
On every issue you talk about it.
Yeah, on every issue. We're now up to volume 33, item 58 or something like that. So there's over maybe 2,500 issues that were created.
There you go. And you send these out whenever you get a pile that's big enough, right?
Yeah, whenever I get time to go and edit it and clean it up and spelling correct it. And
so one of the things I encounter a lot of is people who say, "Who could have ever known?" And my response to them is, if you haven't read every issue of the Risks Forum, then almost certainly the answer is, well, you could have known.
You could have known.
Well, that's because we seem to be really bad of having this history taught in our educational system. And we keep making the same mistake because we just don't bother to keep track of it and teach it.
Well, this is what's known as the Cassandra effect. Cassandra, you may remember, was a seer who saw things that nobody else could believe. And everybody scorned her and said she must be crazy or whatever. And then all of her predictions came true. So I have been saying for years and years and years that you can't trust anything at the moment. The hardware, the software, the people who are using it,
right, of course not.
The environment, the cosmic ray hits on space.
Well, and the fact that we could all get wiped out in an instant. But on the other hand, you must trust or you can't do anything.
Yeah, that's true.
So it's not that you can't and you must. It's just like risks, right? There are trade-offs.
Yeah.
And the fundamental problem we have, I think, is our inability to do the analysis to clearly identify what the desired futures are and differentiate them in terms of what we do from the undesired futures.
Yeah.
So there, in my mind, is sort of the fundamental of what we lack in cybersecurity that we have in almost any other field of endeavor in the educational system. And that is, when you learn chemistry, you start by learning about the history of chemistry and the old chemists and the things they came up with and so forth and all the stuff that went wrong. And when you learn cybersecurity, you don't learn any of that stuff. And when you learn computer programming, you don't learn any of that stuff. When's that going to change?
Well, I've tried to be, maybe I'm a pioneer, but in the courses I teach on cybersecurity, I actually do give the history lessons. I do talk about what has gone right in the past and what has gone wrong in the past, and instill in the students that they need to learn about, you know, successes and failures and apply lessons learned so that they don't repeat the same mistakes and they don't reinvent the wheel.
Is the Risks Forum required reading?
I have never made that required reading. Some of my students come across the Risk Forum. It's not that I don't appreciate the Risk Forum. I forget to tell the students about that. I have actually told my students in a course I teach on system safety that forum exists and they've looked at it. But I think Peter is a gem. He's a treasure in the sense that he's taken on that Sisyphean task of, you know, Sisyphus was the god or demigod that had to push the stone up the mountain and then the stone would roll back down and he had to push it back up. But, you know, Peter, he's constantly gathering these examples of risks and, you know, they just keep coming and he has to keep pushing them into that forum and pushing them out. But I wonder just how many people actually follow the forum or know about it, it is really a treasure that hopefully, you know, our engineering community does take advantage of. I do. I follow it.
So I get these issues and I try to catch up, right? But I'm currently, the oldest one that I have not reviewed recently is from 5/31 of 2022. So, but every once in a while, I get like a weekend off and read 20 of them, you know, and go through them and try to catch up. But it's just, a lot of it's the same stuff, right? So what I did in the late 90s was create this, you know, database of threats, attacks, and defenses and try to just categorize it all and give enough references so you could understand it. And unless I find something new and different, I don't change it. And right. One of the things I found is there are only so many things going on out there.
Right. But I also look at other sources like Slashdot, and there are many other forums out there that keep you pretty current on what's happening. And they're sometimes a little bit more immediate in terms of distribution than, you know, waiting for Peter to distribute the next risk forum issue.
Yeah. My concern is more strategic in nature. Frankly, the next 100 things that happen, the next 100 versions of the Indian fraud or whatever it is,
right?
Who cares, right? So in the cyber show, of course, you know, I have actual fraud examples from emails or whatever that I get, and I just, you know, put them up there during the show because my audience probably hasn't spent the last 50 years learning about this stuff. But I think it's a basic responsibility if you're going to be a professional in any field that you keep up to date on that field. And I think it's a responsibility that in the cyber arena, not just cybersecurity, but in the arena, everybody in information technology, everybody that runs operational technology, all of those people have a professional requirement to be up to date on the nature of these things that happen. And I don't see it as a society. I don't see the professionalization of a field that I would hope to see in terms of people just being aware of what's going on in the world.
Right. And we don't, you know, if you're a mechanical engineer or electrical engineer and you actually have that PE associated with your, you know,
site. Yeah, professional engineer. Yeah.
Yeah. Those people, they actually have to get continuing education unit credit for keeping up. It just kind of keeps them a little bit honest. Same with medical practitioners or healthcare practitioners. But we don't seem to have that in cyber.
Well, no, the CISSP, Certified Information System Security Professional, and the CISM, Certified Information Security Manager, mm-hmm. they're required to have continuing professional education. So there are other requirements in cybersecurity. And this was created, mm-hmm. I think, in the 1980s. And, you know, I'm an ISC squared fellow, so I'm supposed to know this stuff.
Right.
This was created in the 1980s for that purpose. It wasn't intended to be the equivalent of a professional engineer.
Right.
But it was intended to be a baseline to say, you know what the words mean. You're keeping up to date on your field. It's a part of the attempt to create professionalization in the field. There are only about 100,000 or 120,000 CISSPs in the world. There are probably 100 million people in the world, at least, working on information technology who are not keeping up. And the professionalization of the field, despite the fact that we say, oh, any high school kid can build the newest, you know, whatever internet service that, you know, becomes a billionaire. I think professionalization is necessary. And the lack of professionalization is a large part of why we face what we face today in this field.
Right. Yeah. Well, I do agree that we need those lessons learned, coming back to Peter's point. And I think the risk forum is one of those forums that helps serve that purpose. And yeah.
So we'll put a pointer to the risks forum on the show today so that anybody that listens to the show can go there and click on it and read the 2,500 previous issues.
Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies.
This is a little segment of the show we call Cyber Cops. Cyber Cops are the police officers and other law enforcement officials who police the cyber world. And this is their story. So another interesting fraud that's been fairly common lately is they'll intercept an email address. Mm-hmm. I got involved in a couple of these cases. They'll intercept an email address, and so it all gets sent to them. And then the ones that they want to pass on get passed on to the original recipient. The ones they don't want to pass on, they'll delete. So that it's a third-party email box somewhere on the internet, Outlook or what have you. So they'll pull the information from Outlook, allow the normal ones to pass, but delete the ones that they want to take. And then what they're looking for is invoices. So when there's an invoice, it'll have the information on the wire transfer, right? The routing number and the account number and the name. And they'll leave the name and such the same, but they'll just change the routing number and account number to their account number. So this is a bill you were expecting to get, an invoice you're expecting to get. They then, once they've changed that PDF file or whatever was being transmitted to you, they push it back into your email. So you now get the email, but with the PDF altered. And then the receiving party makes the payment, putting in the proper, you know, account number and routing number according to the invoice. It gets sent there. Now, these are wire transfers, so it gets there and, you know, it's done is done. You can't get it back. And these are being done apparently in fairly high volume. So have you ever seen any of those, or were they talking about those at all?
No, not on this particular, professional organization. They didn't mention those. They kind of have focused more on Zelle transfers, issues with that, and the check fraud transitions. But I mean, I'm familiar with that kind of technique because we've had that happen on some of the other fraud cases at the Department of Labor. They may not have actually sent it through a different box, but they'll recreate the invoice so it looks exactly the same, but it has the wrong information on it to go to the defendant, you know, who's committing the crime. So, yes. So they're just like, it's just a way to divert the funds.
Right. And then there are the people that are basically forging their email addresses to send an email from somebody within the organization to another person in the organization to cause them to override some process to allow a check to be sent when it shouldn't be sent. Or almost always it's a wire transfer or some other electronic transfer these days, right? They're not.
Right. For the business enterprise compromise type of email scheme. That's what those are that the Bureau deals with a lot because they're high dollars. And They're a sophisticated form of phishing. So
it used to be long ago, the threshold for most of these things was $5,000, right? So it's not a federally prosecutable computer crime unless it's $5,000 or more in total effect.
Depends on the jurisdiction.
Part of law.
Well, that doesn't have anything. No, that doesn't have anything to do with whether or not they're going to prosecute it. That just means that, the dollar amount has to reach that for the fraud. But, you know, but for prosecution purposes, there's a whole completely different, series.
Yeah, no, I know there are other ways to do it. But the reality of it was that there have always been thresholds underneath which, unless there's a political motivation or something else, they just won't do it. They won't bother. Is that basically right?
Well, yeah, it has to hit something so that it's a federal offense, okay? So it won't meet the federal offense.
Even if it's a federal offense, there's a threshold below which they normally just won't bother.
It usually is a dollar amount. Like in L.A., it was like if your case wasn't $1 million or more, don't bother to call the FBI. So that's why all the other littler agencies like mine, you know, and Inspection Service, IRS, CID, we all would join together so that, you know, we would be able to do the case because, you know, people, just because you didn't reach $1 million in L.A. doesn't mean you get to, you know, commit a crime in L.A.
Well, but in practice, it does, right? In practice, computer criminals have learned what the thresholds are.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And the clever ones just stay below them. Okay.
Right. They also learned that, you know, if they're out of the country, they're, you know, and they keep moving around long enough that nobody's going to want to do the case because whoever was assigned to that case has, you know, will move on. And so then it'll be reassigned to somebody else. It gets stale. And ultimately, you know, somebody, you can try and cut a deal for something far less. I had a defendant that was very good on knowing all of those things about the U.S. Attorney's Office.
Okay, so there's no published numbers, but you got, you know, you find these things out experimentally. Or when I used to work with law enforcement on these sorts of things, I would ask that question occasionally, and they would tell me. and then there was some other work I did where they told me how much dollar value certain transactions should be in order to avoid unnecessary examination.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I don't know how else to say it without...
You mean under
the structuring
threshold for like this the structuring charge. You know, like if you, you know, do your transactions at $9,999.99, you're under the $10,000.
Oh, no, but that's, no, you wouldn't do that. That's different. That's, so that's foreign transactions, right?
But it's structuring, it's money laundering.
Yeah, you know, but so the problem is when you go $9,999.99, you're just begging for them to notice it, right? Sure. We'll be telling more stories from CyberCops in our next show. So don't miss it. Next Wednesday, 9 a.m. Pacific time, KNBY, 1240 a.m. And on the web at thecybershow.co. We're back with Brian, the invention guy. Let's talk about the seedy side of the business, because there is a seedy side to this business, right?
There are people that come to me that have expected certain things that they didn't necessarily get. And I think in any business...
Well, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about your business. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about the general business of trying to help inventors, or saying you're trying to help inventors mm-hmm. with their invention. There is a seedy side to that business as well, right?
The seedy side to any business. That's why you have to do your research. Yeah.
Because one of the things we do on our shows, we talk about frauds and mm-hmm. so forth. So there must be people in that business that do that. Can you give us some examples of what you've seen from other companies? Don't name names. But...
Well, people pay for, so if they come up with an idea, whether their idea is amazing or it might be subpar, they continue without doing a search and doing the due diligence, because they could end up working on something that already exists, you know, and it doesn't mean that it's wrong. It's just their opinion, but that's why it's important to get multiple opinions before you figure out, or at least get the right information. And that's the thing, is I think it's expectations. You know, somebody says, I can help you to bring your product to market. You're thinking that your product is going to be to market. And I think it's important for people to understand what it takes to get there, and what has to be done to get there. It's not just making a, you know, a pretty picture, and all of a sudden you're going to be a gazillionaire. There's some work to do. And I think that sometimes it's bundled up too much. And I think it's kind of, you start to piece it through to find the right way to get it done. And that's what I do, is I kind of guide people through it. But maybe there's other people that do it a different way, or other companies out there. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Then there are people that tell me that they told a big company about their invention once and the company stole it from them.
There's a lot of unfortunate woulda, coulda, shouldas out there. For us as inventors, we have to do the best we can to protect ourselves. I would always suggest a non-disclosure agreement. So when I talk to somebody about my idea, I have them sign a non-disclosure agreement, and I give other inventors NDAs to sign, especially when they're talking to me also. I'm not doing anything with their ideas, but I tell them that this is what you need when you're disclosing your idea to somebody. You should ask for an NDA. So I mean, there's people out there that come to me and they say, you know, I invented this. And then I show them that this product has a patent, you know, much earlier than what they came up with it. So, I mean, yeah, well, I came up with that, but it's 20 years ago. You know what I mean? Or I don't know who they're telling and what people are doing with it, but for the most part, it takes a lot of it takes a lot to be able to commercialize an invention. So somebody would really have to go out of their way to rip it off. But, you know, do your due diligence, make sure you have a non-disclosure agreement signed, keep track. I you know, you can use an email to keep track of who you're sending your emails out to. And there's a provisional patent application. You can file a provisional patent application, which will give you the right. It's very inexpensive. I think it's $100. You file something. If you have somebody draw it up for you or write it up, it's a little bit more. But what it does is it gives you the right for 1 year to say that you're patent pending while you're exploring the market. And before the year is done, you can convert it into a non-provisional patent application, otherwise known as a utility patent.
It becomes a pending patent. It's not a patent.
Right. It's patent pending, but you could put people on notice that you're patent pending and that you should lay off. A lot of times a patent pending status could be much more powerful than an issued patent, because when it's issued, they can actually see what's in the patent. But look, Fred, for me, I know that I always do my best to protect my idea. I go through the due diligence and I protect it. And then I find people that I can trust. And so far, so good. if there are people that aren't necessarily doing the right thing, then hopefully you did your due diligence to know what type of person that was before you started. And that's the best that I could say. There are companies out there that are entitled to make a living. It's up to you to do your research and due diligence before you decide to work with them.
So, Chris, due diligence, trust, know who you're talking to, protect yourself, right?
In the last 9 months of last year, I sailed for 148 days over shark-infested waters. Well, water with sharks in it. And I think that's the point to a lot of the things we talked about with Brian here, right? There's risk in the world. To this point, there are sharks in the water. Look, if you're an inventor and you're looking on cable TV and you see an ad at 3 o'clock in the morning, and it sounds too good to be true, yeah, that's too good to be true. From the sounds of it, there are people like Brian out there. It sounds trustworthy. It sounds like the people I know who do this, but take care of yourself.
So we talk about due diligence in cybersecurity all the time. People just don't do it, or, you know, they can't do it, or whatever, however you want to talk about it. But it's like in every field of endeavor, there are people that are diligent, thoughtful, that are hardworking, that do what you're supposed to do. And then there are all these other people who don't, who complain, right?
Right. And, you know, there's only a couple of possible end states, right? You know, you can not do your diligence and it could work. And you can do your diligence and it could work. But, you know, it's about reducing the risk and increasing the odds. Again, if you have a positive attitude and you're thoughtful about what the competitive advantage, critical topic, sharing your invention. Personally, I think that most of the time your competitors are not paying that much attention to you. It depends. And we overthink it and we hide too much. The other hand, if you don't hide the actual important things, yes, you know, a big company may actually be printing your thing and selling it because you have no legal recourse. And it's sad, but you have to think these things through.
Well, the other interesting thing he said, which I sort of find, you know, fascinating in its way, is that it takes a lot to succeed. It's not like it's a simple thing to build out a company and all these capabilities. And so why should they steal your idea when they have lots and lots of other ones they could work on? If you haven't done anything to protect yourself and it's just out there and it's that good an idea, then others are going to do it. I will tell you this, in startups and in the startup world, if you can't describe it well enough without an NDA, I'm not interested. And part of the reason is that you're going to have to sell it. So what has to not be disclosed that you can't tell me about that's so sensitive? I mean, if that's the nature of it, how are you ever going to sell it?
Well, you know, I've tried many times to explain this to people I work with, business partners sometimes, right? You know, it's like, look, if we sell our competitors' information about what we're worried they're going to find about us, what would that change about what we do? And I think most of the time, nothing. We're busy to begin with, right? You know, I like to know what my competitors are doing. Yeah, that's great to know. It's market validation, or maybe they're missing something that, you know, that we're seeing, you know, I'm seeing, or we're seeing in advance. But yeah, don't, again, this is, you know, standard cybersecurity stuff or security of any sort. You know, don't over or underestimate the value of things. Otherwise, you can't build a protective practice around that that makes sense. And people worry about their intellectual property, you know, in this broad, fuzzy sort of way that includes everything. And so they end up not protecting any of it particularly well, or they stifle themselves so much that they can't get other things done. Really clear about it. You know, how much value does this really have? Protect it appropriately. Move on.
So focus of attention has everything to do with this, right?
Yep.
And so I think a lot of people, they're not looking at the right stuff.
Well, they're busy. That's what Brian does, right? You know, he takes people who are busy with one thing, and he's found something he can specialize in and help them at that time. Most anything that any of us do, anybody else could do. So why don't we all do all of it ourselves? Because we're busy.
Right. Everything's figure outable, to quote from somebody I know.
That was a YouTube video I saw. I don't know if I shared that with you just recently, but yeah, everything is figure outable, and it just is. You know, somebody's already figured out everything that exists, and if it can be done, somebody else will probably figure that out.
When you figure out something and then you try to make it successful, almost by definition, it can't be successful by you alone. It's got to be successful because you engaged other people. Again, depending what your definition of success is, but if it's going to be commercially successful, it's going to be because somebody else thought it was valuable enough to give you money for it.
On the cybersecurity thread, what really talking to ISAC folks who are actively running a good active information sharing analysis center right now, and I'm talking to all sorts of, you know, supply chain folks, and saying to a bunch of ISAC folks who've been trying to get, you know, working so hard on threat intelligence and getting trust and so forth for quite a few years now, that they are the topic of conversation in the supply chain world, in large part because I'm there saying, look, you know, we're working through this already. And the intellectual property control issue in both cases compared to how it's done without this. how do companies really control their intellectual property? They sign contracts. That's it. You know, the rest is up to, I guess my employees are probably sticking to that as far as I can tell. So I think we get better at controlling intellectual property decade to decade going forward, not worse. Find out that what we thought was safe before we started worrying about it was terrible security to begin with.
So I get involved in intellectual property cases, legal cases. And a lot of what I see, I'm looking at one right now. I don't want to obviously go into any details. What is the value of that intellectual property? And this in cybersecurity, a long time ago, there was some very large scale for that time frame attack. And within days of the discovery and publication of the attack, there were claims about the value of what was lost that ranged over, I think it was like six orders of magnitude, from a couple hundred dollars to a couple, you know, $100 million. And this is post facto, right? So this is looking at it backwards, saying, well, after the fact, this is what it was worth. No, this is what it... So when you talk about intellectual property protection, what's important for the business, this idea of putting monetary value on it, I think, first of all, it's very difficult to do because I can find generally a range, a minimum and a maximum, but I can't tell you where it is in the middle. When it comes to making protection decisions, to me, it can only be understood in the context of the business. And it's not a dollar value associated with the business. It's a success or failure value associated with the business. It's whether you can continue to operate and operate in the manner you want to. And so it's very hard to manage risk when financial aspects are the only things you're looking at.
And a little bit of a swirl here, but this is the cyber show. This might be worth a fun one. So 25 years ago, 1998, summer 98, I'd taken over the firewall product lines at Cisco, the product line manager, and I was approached by Cisco lawyers or the, you know, the DA, the district attorney maybe, but and apparently there was an employee who was hired by the company that made one of the firewalls that Cisco acquired like 6 weeks before the acquisition. And this person was a total unpleasant pain in the and then left right after the acquisition and started a firewall company and had the same typos in the product literature and the same source code and everything else. What is this intellectual? The guy says, well, it's Silicon Valley. Everybody shares everything. It's all fine.
No.
And it's like, how much is this worth? It's like right now about $150 million a year.
And now a word from our sponsor.
Tuesday, April 11th, go to Angel. Pitch your company to investors, get a global listing, and get on the cyber show. Sign up at a2e.co.
We're talking with Simpson here, who has a long career, both as a cybersecurity, we'll call it threat actor for the moment, and as a journalist. Simpson, after you spent time at the Franklin Institute and reading books and reading code and punching paper tapes and so forth, what was the next major step forward in your adventure in the cyber world?
Well, I was fortunate. My father had some money and our family and friends had some money. So I'm Jewish. And for my 13th birthday, I had my bar mitzvah and I got a computer for my bar mitzvah. But basically, it was too expensive for one person to give me a computer. So different friends in the family, different family members all gave me pieces of the computer. And somebody gave me the CPU card, and somebody gave me the memory card, and somebody gave me the cassette interface card.
Yeah, so you had to put it together, which is part of learning about computers, right?
Yes, indeed. And when I got home, it didn't work. And the computer store said, did you reseat all the boards? And I'm like, of course I did. But I had no idea what he meant by that, right? And so he said, okay, we'll bring it back. So I brought it back and he reseated all the boards. And they said, it works fine. I'm like, what did you do? He said, well, I unplugged every board and plugged them back in because sometimes get loose during travel. That machine had 16K of RAM.
Whoa, it's a big one.
Well, it was a Z80 made by a company called Technical Design Labs. They ended up failing, of course, like most of the companies. But I wanted more memory, so I bought a 32K DRAM card, which I had to assemble, and it didn't work when I assembled it, so I sent it to the company, and they said that one of the chips had been plugged in backwards, so they took it out, they plugged it in properly and sent it back to me, and it worked fine. So there was a lot of that going on with me. The fundamental problem, I guess, was I was very bad at reading directions.
Not bad at following them, just bad at reading them?
Well, I have dyslexia, so I'm actually bad at reading them.
Yeah, so it was plugged in backwards because you interpreted it backwards. Perfect. Okay. So is this part of how you developed your hacking skills?
So the first hacking thing was we had these Apple II computers by this time at my in my high school, and I was also taking classes at the college across the street, Bryn Mawr College. And originally I signed up for like a Fortran course, and that was boring because I learned Fortran in the first week. Then for the semester was half there, so I just did like independent research, which means I wrote a graphics program in Fortran. I wrote another graphics program in APL. And at the end of that, I decided independent research was a waste of time. There were all these classes I could be taking, and I started
right,
my
campus. So just to fill in, right, APL, a programming language.
Yeah, APL is a programming language developed at IBM in the 1960s. And it uses lots of strange symbols. So if you want to assign, like the row is an operator and left arrow.
Yeah, iota of row and yeah.
Yeah. So
if they don't know what we're talking about, this won't help them. And if they do, they already know.
Right. Well, there are APL simulators online. So those are kind
of fun. You can get APL today. Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, you can.
In fact, I even have an APL keyboard that allows me to use the symbols instead of going .io and so forth.
Right. Yeah, they're an APL terminal only had uppercase characters. And our APL terminal at Bryn Mawr College was a Daisy Wheel printer. So one day, so I guess my real hacking career started one day. I was trying to get into the high school computer room and it was locked. And so I said, well, I have a whole bunch of keys in my pocket. Let me just try them all. And it turned out that the key from the Bryn Mawr College computer room, which I had a key to because I was an operator there, also opened the high school computer room. So
of course.
I assumed it was just a generic computer room key and it would just open them all. And that was kind of neat because now I could open the computer room whenever I wanted. And we stopped having to ask the teachers. I had a friend who he was hacking the chemistry room and stealing chemicals from the supply closet. That's a different story, but we were making explosives too. And then I started like thinking, oh, you know, like people are just putting their floppy disks into these Apple II computers and really trusting them. We could do something very malicious. So so I wrote a program that said, insert your disk and I'll store something on it. And somebody did, and it wiped their disk, right? You know, I thought that was very funny. And he lost all of his work. And then that's what taught me that hacking people is just kind of boring because they're helpless.
And it's harmful to them, and it's mean.
It's harmful and mean.
But not hacking, attacking, right?
This is just pure attacking.
But just technically speaking, so if you did that today, you could be arrested as a terrorist, right?
If you did that today in a high school, you could get expelled.
Including the chemistry set and making explosives.
Oh, yeah, totally.
All right, so
but wait.
Not a terrorist because you were too early.
There was another case where a friend of mine had stolen login credentials to a computer system of a school system in Lower Merion, I think. And so we logged in. It was a Prime system. And I want to point out for all of your readers that this was not illegal to do in the 1970s. Yeah,
but Simpson, you know, we're on radio. They're not readers. They're listeners.
Yeah, right. So this was not illegal to do. And I was underage. So,
and the statute of limitation is now passed.
So we'll get to that. So anyway, we logged into this computer and we saw, oh, this is kind of cool. But we didn't really know what to do with it. So we wrote a program that created copies of itself. And what it would do is it would save itself under a different file name. And every copy was itself. And so we figured this is really funny. And all the system operators have to do to delete it is change the create line in the basic program to a delete line. It'll delete all the copies of itself. And it's like no harm done. And uh-huh. And I found out that that they completely freaked out that when they came in on Monday and discovered tens of thousands of files in the computer's directories, and they were terrified to run the program and change it. So they just manually deleted all the copies. And again, this was more lesson that people are just, you know, it's not worth attacking people because they're just too vulnerable.
So just for clarity, what year was that?
maybe 1977, maybe 1977.
So that was a computer virus.
Yes. I guess so.
Yeah, it wasn't called that at the time, but all right. And but you didn't, it didn't get published widely or anything like that. So it turns out, you know, we need to add that to the history books now. I did. Okay.
But self-replicating programs go back to the 50s, right?
Well, von Neumann. Yeah.
Yeah, von Neumann was very interested
That's
in
right. them. All right. Okay. So, boy, do I have some comments on that one.
I'll bet.
The first one is haves and have-nots. Right. So this is such a clear distinction. He's in a high school in the 1970s, early 1970s, and he has access to Apple computers at his high school. And he goes across the street to a university where he has access to more computers. That's clearly something that the vast majority of everybody just didn't have in that time frame.
Right. And, you know, popular culture is full of those stories. Bill Gates happened to be at an early age, have access to those systems because of who he was and where he came from.
Number two, forget the haves and have nots. How about the unethical and ethical?
Right. Well, you know, ethical development, as you know, as we're kids, you know, we don't necessarily think about things and you know, cause people, but did you mean to harm? Was there ill intent? And that's extremely rare.
The answer is yes.
Yeah.
Right. He's over that ill intent threshold again and again. And he explains that the reason not to do it isn't because of something ethical or anything like that. It's because it's just too easy.
Too easy. That's right. Boring.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, to me, that's problematic. You know, I also learned that same set of things. Right. When I was young, you know, I ended up understanding how keys work and finding out that a key works somewhere where it shouldn't work. But I didn't then go and use that key again. What I did is I told the people in charge, you know, there's potentially a problem here, and so they could fix it. And I think that that's a fundamental difference between, you know, ethics and morals of different people. And I think it's enormously problematic when you do things that harm other people. And the reason you decide to stop is because it's boring.
Well, it's a reason, at least.
Well, what it means is if you find something more exciting, you'll go and do it.
Yeah. You know, and as I'm sitting here thinking, I think, you know, I try to be ethical and moral. I think I always have. However, right, you know, I have enjoyed, you know, hacking into physically or not, you know, getting access to things, you know, unauthorized and so forth. You know, never doing any harm just because I can't. So there's a certain justification in there of, you know, I'm not really hurting anything, but.
Right. And this particular edge to me is a fascinating edge. That's, you know, because especially when you're young, you don't know what that edge is. You don't know what it is to feel bad about something. But, you know, when you delete somebody else's work.
Right.
By your malicious acts, you know, that's real harm to that person. But,
right.
But
you know, that's a task, you know, that's supposed to be accomplished by Microsoft Word.
Yeah.
You know, honestly, I'll pick on the LinkedIn app is the only thing that does that to me today. You know, the world has gotten much better. You remember that? You know, the oh my God feeling. Everybody listening knows that feeling of a certain age, right? Where you've written the paper or whatever and it's gone. It's just gone, right? You know, there's no way to get it back.
Interestingly, that's one of the many things that I learned about a reason to get into forensics because I did get them back. Yeah. But, you know, look, one of my problems is I, you know, do backups every month. You know, there's a standard regimen, right? Incrementals weekly, monthly, full backups and so forth. And one month I missed it. I missed it by a day, right? So as I was Friday or Saturday, where I didn't do my backup. And the next day the computer crashed and I lost a whole bunch of work. And it's just my nature that if I ever miss something or fail to do my job, it's going to go wrong. It's not just a little bit wrong. It's going to go wrong badly.
It's not you, it's Murphy. Right.
No, I think there are people that are lucky in that way and people that are unlucky in that way. And, you know, luck favors the prepared. You know, I believe that that's right. But on the other hand, I'm incredibly lucky in other ways. So you think about, you know, the genie in the bottle, right? You know, just enormous, global, unbelievable power. It's like, no, I can do anything except I have to live in a bloody bottle with a cap on the top of it. I think that that's part of the nature of it. But I really think that these ethical issues are fundamental to the challenges we have in cybersecurity. And they are very deep and they are very critical to the survival of humanity as we work in groups and more collaboratively and we have more interconnection between things and more interdependencies.
Let's be clear about this. You know, Socrates and Thrasymachus were arguing about this. You know, these are long fundamental issues, right? And I think, again, it comes back to my posit that good triumphs evil, you know, not because good is like somehow endowed with whatever, because in the end, it's more efficient. It works better.
It does not. That historically, I disagree with you. I think
historically, no, I understand history perfectly well, but I think what we show is incrementing towards that, and it's a long bloody curve. You know, in thousands of years of working on this, is it actually better to be ethical or not?
Well, no, I think at least for today, crime pays. It continues to pay. Now that could change, you know, any day. But if you look at, you know, for example, people, the United States is supposed to be, you know, this shining, you know, city on top of the hill. But, you know, France prosecuted their top politicians, you know, put them in jail and gets out of jail and gets reelected. Okay, well, so, you know, that's part of the deal. But in the United States, we don't prosecute those top politicians unless they do really way over the top horrible things. And then it's highly questionable.
And well, right? in Russia, they don't prosecute them at all, but they fall out of windows.
It's interesting when you say they fall out of windows, they slip. They're not falling out of the windows. Typically, they slip and they fall through the windows. Even if they only fall like three stories, they always break their neck and die.
I know. This kids is why we have non-skid services.
And that's the advantage of the West. The West, we have
non-skid services, you know, near high windows. It's actually the security accomplishment of the 21st century.
Well, I think there's also something about the shoes you wear. If you have those very fancy shoes, they tend to be very slippery on the bottom. At least today, crime pays. And as much as I'm against that, and I think most people are good people, when you squeeze somebody enough, they're, you know, that's the end of it, right? If your family has to eat, you will steal. Right.
I've always had, you know, talking in environmental conversations, right? You know, if the last breeding pair of pick something pandas walked by and my family's starving, literally, you know, we're having steak, right? We have to solve, you know, the needs of people if we're going to solve the needs of these other finer point issues.
So time frames are also critically important here, right?
Right.
The difference, when you look at the course of somebody's life in the short term, they may be doing wrong things. They may or may not get caught. You know, somebody else who gets caught ends up in jail. They have a completely different path in their life than the person who didn't get caught, got away with it and looked back on it and said, oh my God, I almost got caught. Completely different from the person that got away with it, didn't get caught and says, oh, if I don't get caught at that, I won't get caught at this. You know, you talk about this fractal nature of things, right? This is one of those things where the butterfly wings make a difference in the future of that individual.
I think organized crime is a good example of this. You don't see a lot of old mobsters, right? You know, it's a survivor bias, you know, because, you can die your way to the top.
On the other hand, you know, the question is, how did they live before they died? So they're sort of, you know, they're way better off for a period of time and then they lose it, right? But that's all right. The candle that burns twice as brightly burns half as long, right?
Maybe so.
Yeah, well, I hope to live a long time. And I hope to burn brightly.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Fred here. On April 4th, we have our monthly advisory call for Angel to Exit. Join us to discuss anything you want about your early stage company. Later that day, we'll have the CEO's Forum, where portfolio company CEOs get together and discuss issues and help each other identify synergistic improvements. On April 11th, go to Angel. You can pitch your company, get in front of investors, get on the radio show, and tell the world about your new company. Also on April 11th, the All.net Members Forum. You can meet with cybersecurity experts from around the world and discuss all sorts of interesting things. For more details, go to thecybershow.co.
We're talking to Doug, who has spent a lifetime dealing with the issues of identity management and has consulted for many of the largest enterprises in the world in this arena. Doug, welcome back.
Thank you.
When we last spoke, we were just starting to talk about directory services and X.500.
Yes.
So let's talk about directory services. You got into it early, and when, you know, you were talking about telephone directories, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, it's moved on from then.
Yes.
So tell us about sort of the next sequence of steps in your evolution through that.
Well, I'd be happy to. And actually, it evolved very, very quickly beyond a white pages directory for telcos. It was, in fact, 1991 when I was working for IBM. And IBM wasn't able to sell an awful lot of OSI, but this pesky little suite of protocols called TCP/IP was really starting to make a lot of noise. Remember now, this is late 80s, early 90s, well before the web or anything like that. And there's this University of Michigan team that came out with something called the Lightweight Directory Access Protocol, LDAP, which was intended to be a layer 7 and 6 overlay on X500 directories. But what it actually did was it instantiated its own database in lieu of X500, meaning that it could function as a directory service without having OSI X500 below it. And in 1991, when that rolled out, IBM came to me and said, well, you know a lot about directories. We would like to see if you and a couple of guys could port the University of Michigan LDAP code from what it was written on back then, Sun Solaris, to IBM's Unix AIX. And we have a big customer that would like to see this rolled out as a means for it to put in place a directory service for email, for SMTP. Again, so OSI was being left behind. Internet protocols were taken over. This company was the Electric Power Research Institute.
They had EPRI, of course. So just for clarity here, so you were writing programs, and for some reason they decided you should be writing the software to support essentially X.500 for TCP/IP.
My team leader realized after working for her for a couple of years that I was pretty good with customers, right? Because they needed somebody who could go talk to a customer, find out what they needed, and translate back to the development lab, if you will, what needed to be done, what they were looking for. And not waste time on the weeds, if you know what I mean, and just focus on bringing some value. And so at that point in time, in 1991, IBM asked me to join their professional services. And that began my life as a consultant. From that point on, I never looked back. I left the lab and development, and I focused almost solely on architecture, design, integration, which is a big part of it, and implementation. Mostly the front end stuff that I could hand off to teams to run. And it was all right, around.
But just for clarity, so now were you effectively a manager telling development teams what to do, or a salesperson, or a consulting? What exactly would you call yourself in that role?
I was called a wild duck in IBM's terms in those days. That was all of the above. I was not a bag carrying salesperson with I had no quota or anything like that. I was not in marketing or anything, but they needed, there was a dearth, and there probably still is today, of people who can translate business to technology. And the people that were working at IBM down in the networking systems OSI lab were exceedingly technical, far more technical than I was. But, you know, the old couldn't see the forest for the trees, didn't know what they were putting out there and for what, you know.
Well, they had the engineer's disease, right?
Yeah, exactly.
For the audience who doesn't know yet what the engineer's disease is, there are a couple of symptoms. One of the symptoms is after they've said yes to the sale, the engineer has to explain now all of the potential things that could go wrong so as to lose the sale. That's the first part of the engineer's disease.
Yes.
The other one is, let's see, the engineer's disease says you believe you have to speak the whole truth. The problem being, what exactly would the whole truth be? And the answer is that means you can talk forever.
Yeah, exactly. And lose your customer again in the weeds, right?
Yeah. And then the third problem is just a lack of, so I used to call this translation, right? Mm-hmm. And I used to advertise some of my consulting services as we can translate between the executives and the technologists. And part of it is just that they use the same words for different meanings.
Exactly. Right? Yes.
So now you're this wild duck working for IBM.
Yes.
Helping to determine what customer wants, translate it into people in the lab can do, take whatever they do, translate that into what people want. Presumably you work with salespeople to close sales, right?
Yes, absolutely. I became salespeople's best friend because I was that translator between the technology and the business problems a salesperson wanted to be able to sell to.
Yeah. So this is a fairly standard approach in my experience. Is you have the salesperson that has the customer relationship.
Yep.
And then you have the technical person that's not doing the technology, but they still know the technical answers. So they can give you honest answers and tell you any misimpressions you might have. But the other thing is there's a pricing issue in there.
Yeah.
And so usually the technical person can't really do the pricing that well. And the salesperson has their standard pricing book, but they don't know how to do the estimates.
Exactly.
So then there's this third estimator, and a good person in that position that you had can also do the estimates.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. This went immediately with that EPRI thing we were talking about. The very first big project that they put me on went far beyond just the technology. It was about integration. It was about systems integration. It was about butts in seats, installing, configuring, maintaining, and operating what was being put in place. And to be able to bid something like that required a level of expertise, even that the engineers didn't really have. You know what I mean?
Yeah, because they didn't know how many, you know, of them it was required to put in a light bulb, right?
Exactly, exactly.
I think it's now called a sales engineer.
Right, SEs, yeah.
It's so, you know, fundamental, right? He starts out wanting to, you know, be an optician, right? Goes to, learns about computers because his dad says, you know, this is a growing thing, you can get a job here. Ends up, you know, getting a job and then goes over to IBM, who hires him as soon as he shows up saying, howdy, I can do stuff. Has him writing programs and then becomes what he calls, what they call a wild duck, right? Which is like, doesn't fit anywhere, right?
Yep.
But becomes important to everyone. And now, you know, he's sort of the only guy that can actually figure out how to price things because he's the only one that has that set of insight, that translation function.
Yeah, I think there's been, you know, by some the set of folks, and I think a lot of them are our peers, you know, who've been floating along over the last couple of decades doing just that, right? And we look at what's going on in the current time with, you know, AI and, you know, expert systems and everything else. It really wasn't possible. You know, listen to Doug talk about integration in the early 90s. To be clear, we're still working this out now. Yes, the systems we have are fractally more complex, so the challenge is harder, but there's fundamentals we're still working on. Right. So back in those days, you basically had someone with that intuitive ability to just in their head, put it all together and explain it in human words so you could at least do something.
Yeah. The other thing is, you know, for some reason in my mind, 91 is recent, but it's 30 plus years ago.
Right.
So I'm like, oh, the 90s, that's fairly modern. Then, you know, the late 90s, oh, that's when the web started. Oh, man, you know, I don't remember how far back that is when I think about it. So people with 30 years of experience were here when you were still typing text into glass screens and there was no graphical interface to speak of compared to what we have today. And you certainly couldn't share a video or anything like that. It is such a different world. And so the engineers or the people writing programs are doing completely different things now than they did then for the most part. And the salespeople are doing things completely differently than they were. But for some reason, those people in the middle, I think they're still doing the same thing.
I mean, the first computer things I played with as a kid, you know, so born in 65. So in the early 70s, you know, 5-6 years old, my dad was working at as a systems engineer at IBM. And punch cards, you know, doing all sorts of things with that. But the flowchart template, the green plastic thing with, you know, squares and so forth. You know, so I was playing with that at 5 or 6 years old, right? You know, and understanding what it is. It's like, this leads to that, leads to that, right? That really hasn't changed. It's funny, we pick on slideware all the time. I love slides. PowerPoint, whatever, right? You know, let me graphically put things together. And maybe it's because as a kid there, I'm literally, you know, barely knowing any English language, but, you know, just, you know, putting these little boxes, trying to design things in my life. This leads to that, right? Now, I've always come from the opposite direction. You know, to me, these chunks are functional things I can see in my head and fixing them on paper and moving them around. And then, you know, writing code and everything else is just pedantic.
So that's very interesting because when you talk about slideware and writing slides and graphics, one of the things I learned when I was at Burton Group, which is where I really started to spend a lot of time with Doug, was they kept doing these graphical depictions of things. And they would describe things. You'd have all the text and all that stuff, but you'd always have to make a picture. And, you know, the picture is worth more than 1,000 words. In terms of showing the relationship, figuring out how to put things together in the picture, figuring out how to structure it in a multidimensional context on a two-dimensional piece of paper with maybe some colors. That's fascinating. And it does have a big effect. As you start to depict it, you start to learn more about it.
Well, yeah, I always like the one of the interesting things about the human mind is that we can find in a plowed field an arrowhead. Why? You know, you have all the shapes you can see in your visual. It's amazing our ability to fixate on those sort of things and see things in patterns.
Right. So it's also, you know, that's the basis of Decider and Influence, these tools I built, you know. So this whole cognitive computing realm is that the visual cortex and the brain behind that is able to handle more things that are much more complex than what you can handle as a set of, you know, sequences of words or sentences or lines or something like that, right? So this complex structuring that your brain is able to do with vision is very different. And of course, you know, sound's another completely different area. So I think these multimodal learning that's been identified as how you learn better is by getting the information in more than one mode and playing with it, so to speak. There's different aspects of cognition in people, and that the smarter people, the people that are better at what they do, use more of those to do those developments.
Well, yeah, then there's synesthesia, right? You know, the thinking in shapes and colors and so forth. We've discussed this in the show before, right? Again, I'm one of those folks, you know, to me, you know, flowchart makes sense because it's how I think, right? There's these chunks and blobs and shapes and connectivity and so forth. So just, you know, as we're discussing here, depicting those, you know, and saying to, you know, with Doug in the early 90s, right? That's when I started in security and first got into PowerPoint and so forth. And I just found it just priceless to say, okay, here, you know, firewalls, a box between two clouds. Let's just talk about that. You know, the same information in pages of text. In 1991, 92, people get the concept in their head.
Next week on the Cyber Show, another pitcher comes to bat. Peter goes up the stack. Julie and it just don't look right. Simpson gets more bad advice. Doug goes advisory. More frauds against the odds. And much more. Next week on the Cyber Show.
A good time and foul. A good time. A string beating man and a fiddler for a band. A good time. Had
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.